Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Hey, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm here with my co-host, Max Linsky, Evan Ratliff.
What's up, Aaron?
I'm really excited to be here.
I'm excited to be here, too. It's weird that I'm so excited in the morning.
Aaron, coming off of 19 coffees.
This week, Evan talked to Patrick Radden Keefe of The New Yorker.
Staff writer at The New Yorker, author of two books, Chatter and Snakehead, The Snakehead. A guy who reports about national security, he reports about spies, he reports about
human smuggling,
drug cartels. He really gets inside the criminal syndicate and the intelligence world in an amazing way.
Yeah. Our sponsor this week is Tiny Letter.
Tinyletter.com.
They are a simple yet deeply powerful way to send email newsletters from the good people at MailChimp. Take it away, Evan.
All right, I'm here with Patrick Radden Keefe, who's come up from D.C. kindly for an atavist event this evening to talk about drugs, cartels, murder, all of the above, and also joining us on the podcast today. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So I made a little list, a topic-based list of stories that you've done, and it goes like this. Drug cartels, human smuggling, arms dealers, fake wine, antiquities trading, the murder capital of New York, terrorism, basically any sort of illicit industry that I can think of. There may be ones that I can't think of. I haven't seen a straight up prostitution story that you've done. I might have missed that one.
I aspire to one day.
But this all sort of leads me to start with the question, was this a fascination that grew from somewhere else, or did you just fall into reporting about illicit networks?
I think it sort of happened in a sideways manner. I had done, like you, I had been really interested in the kind of growth of the counterterrorism apparatus post 9/11, and wrote a book called Chatter, which is looking at wiretapping and kind of global eavesdropping. And there was a sense in which that was, as you know well, it's kind of empirically you're in a tricky place because you're trying to sort of map out something that is ultimately kind of impossible to map. There's a limit to how much you can know. And I think philosophically, I'm just drawn to that kind of area. And then I did this piece in 2006. I guess I started in 2005 about Sister Ping, this woman in Chinatown who was a human smuggler. And spending time in Chinatown and hearing about this whole kind of illicit economy where she was bringing people over who would pay her to be smuggled to the United States, but then they would be here working in restaurants and she would then send their money back to China through an underground bank. Mm-hmm. I kind of had this glimpse of this whole kind of global underground economy in which you know, the market sort of reigns and you can move or buy anything. And it's intricate and sophisticated and really hard to report on, but kind of compelling. And I just kept going back to the well on that. And so in a sense, I just keep rewriting the same story. But the characters and the stuff that's happening are varied enough that it's certainly kept me busy and interested.
Yeah, you mentioned that we were both working on sort of intelligence networks, counterterrorism things. I was working on a book that ended up being much more about people who were kind of like entrepreneurially going after the Homeland Security market and also sort of how we were addressing Homeland Security. But I can't remember at what point your book hit, but it was one of those where I saw it and I just went, fuck.
See, I said the same thing about yours.
Fuck. First of all, that was the most interesting stuff. Like, that was what I thought, like, that's what you should write a whole book about. Like, what is happening with these surveillance networks? But before that, you had not written. I mean, I didn't remember seeing your byline previous to that. So you were in school then?
I was in law school, yeah. I sort of took a weird... I don't know whether this would be true today, but I started law school in 2001, and I knew I wanted to be a writer. I knew I wanted to write, but I'd never really published anywhere. And in a kind of perverse way, I think the barriers to entry for me to publish a book at that time were actually lower than they would have been for me to like get a feature assignment at The Atlantic or mm-hmm. something. I know this in part because I tried to get magazine assignments and couldn't.
At that time?
Yeah. I had been in grad school initially, straight out of college. I went to the UK for a couple of years and I was in grad school over there. And I didn't really know what I was doing, you know, so I would like kind of write articles on spec and send them off in hard copy. And, you know, I mean, I sort of...
Like literally print them out and send
them?
Yeah.
It's embarrassing. Fantastic. Today. And never really got anywhere with that. But yeah, so I did this book, and then through the experience of writing the book, I was able to start writing for magazines, which was, I think in some ways I did it backwards. But
yeah, for most people, I would say that's sort of the inverse experience. But then, so just stepping back, so you decided to go to law school as a sort of route to becoming a writer, or as a sort of, I'll have a fallback position. I can always get a job kind of thing, because I feel like that's like half the freelance writers in the world are still saying at whatever age they are, like, maybe I can always go to law school if I need to.
It's funny. So, yeah, I mean, I tend to be kind of risk averse by temperament. And I also think it's just a weird business. I mean, it's and I freelance for years and years, and it's not it's still a tough business. I mean, in terms of actually making a living. So yeah, I did always have this sense in mind of, well, I got to have a day job, or at least the ability to have a day job.
Mm-hmm. So then here you are, you've not done any magazine writing. Mm-hmm. You've not really done much reporting or any reporting. And so you pick basically the most obscure, difficult to uncover any information about topic that you could possibly come up with, which is the NSA. But how do you... Did you try to train yourself to become a reporter? Did you try to read it? How did you know how to go report something?
I mean, I didn't, I should say. And there are features. That's a book that I would write very differently today. Mm. In a weird way, I was afforded this incredible opportunity, which was to spend a couple of years learning how to report and write a book. When we pitched the book initially, you know, in the proposal, I mean, it was essentially, in some ways, it was kind of a meta project. The idea was, at that time, it's 2001, 9/11 has just happened. Suddenly, this very obscure area that people don't know a lot about has become much more germane. At that point, I think James Bamford's second book had just come out. So there had basically been two books written about the NSA and its 50-year history, and they'd both been written by the same guy. Compared to, you know, a card catalog of books on the CIA and the
movies,
FBI,
everything,
right, everything.
Yeah.
So in some ways, my kind of slightly arch way of putting it was, you know, I wanted to write a book about the impossibility of writing a book about the NSA.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the reference points for me were weird. Like, I halfway through, my editor gave me That book, Out of Sheer Rage, by Jeff Dyer, where he, you know, it's just sort of
that
Jeff
is
Dyer,
one of my favorite books.
It's a
actually.
Great book, yeah. But about him kind of trying to write a book about D.H. Lawrence, which I know is a weird analog, but it was a really useful one for me because I think that in some ways, you sort of have to incorporate that level of self-consciousness in writing about a subject like that. I don't know how successful it was, but I sort of learned as I went.
That book is also interesting because it simultaneously romanticizes the writer's life and sort of demystifies the writer's life. He's always traveling around the world. I remember he's looking for like the perfect desk to write at, and he spends all this time finding it, and then he finally finds it. It has like in Paris a view of the Eiffel Tower, and he can't write a thing.
Right, exactly.
And then he misses all the old desks he had with no view.
Yeah.
Did you start thinking of yourself as, okay, if I do this book, like, this is going to be it. Like, I'm going to launch a writing career? Or was this sort of like, I'll write this book, I'll go back to being a lawyer, I'll see what happens, I'll do some stuff on the side?
Well, I never really wanted to be a lawyer. I mean, that's the thing. I didn't go into law school with good faith, I'd say, in that respect. And every month when I write the loan check, even to this day, I wouldn't say it's a decision I rue. There's always some legal aspect to the stuff I write, and it was certainly very helpful, particularly with research, to get that education. But so in some ways I came out thinking, how can I avoid being a lawyer? And I had really enjoyed writing, and I started doing, towards the end of law school, I took a year off to finish the book, and I got an assignment to write a long-ish piece, or, you know, like a 4,000 word piece for the New York Review of Books. And that was sort of the first time I really got a shot at really doing magazine writing. This was when Barbara Epstein was still alive and famously, you know, used to give young, untested writers the opportunity to do that sort of thing.
That's still coming in at the deepest end of the pool.
It was a hugely lucky break, yeah. And she was great and amazingly patient. I mean, I still remember that first like piece of long writing that I gave to her, which
what
she
was it about?
To. So it ended up being a chapter in the book. There had been this woman who was a British eavesdropper who, this is in the run-up to the Iraq War, she sort of blew the whistle, and she there was a classified memo which she fed to the Observer, the newspaper in the UK, and she was prosecuted under the Official Secrets Act. And I went over and interviewed her. I got her to talk to me, and so it ended up being a chapter in the book. But it was just a lucky break. Like, nobody had really been paying attention to that story on this side of the ocean, and I managed to get her to talk to me, and it kind of went from there.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's sort of an issue in general. I mean, when you talk about the kinds of areas that you're looking into, which are usually extremely secretive by virtue of either the government wanting them to stay secret or being illicit in some way and wanting to be secret, and there's this sort of kind of reporters like James Risen or Risen mm-hmm. for the Times, you know, who's written about the NSA, who basically spent a career developing sources that eventually will sort of pan out, as far as I can tell. Whereas it seems more like you're dropping into an area where you're starting, maybe not new, you probably have a greater depth of knowledge than most people, but how do you penetrate some area like that? Where do you start?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't, again, the kind of deliberate, like, I mean, Gonzo is like the farthest thing from my kind of authorial persona, but I mean, to some extent, the approach was, there's going to be a lot of first person singular here, and some of it was literally, you know, I know that there is this massive moon based looking American eavesdropping installation right in the middle of the Yorkshire Moors in the UK, where 2,000 Americans live and eavesdrop on things going on around the planet. They're never going to let me in and let me interview anyone, but I can at least go and walk the perimeter and talk to people in the area. And I think because it was such a, it was a topic that really hadn't been reported on, in some ways I had some stuff that in fact would seem pretty amateur if everybody was on the story,
mm-hmm.
I was able to make a bit of hay with. And then there was other stuff where I kind of had to be a little creative. I mean, there was one thing I did that, this was fun. So, you know, for years, the NSA wouldn't take out patents because mm-hmm. it was always so far ahead of any kind of consumer R&D that they never worried. It was just never worth it because you wouldn't want to expose what you had done, and they weren't really worried about Silicon Valley or anyone else. And then in the 90s, as things really start getting going in a pretty serious way in Silicon Valley, they start beginning to worry, and they start taking out patents because they're essentially worried that, you know, private inventors are going to come up with stuff.
What is the NSA patenting? Is it like encryption?
All kinds of stuff. Yeah, encryption stuff, voice recognition stuff, and you know the bargain in a patent is that you get the exclusive right, but you also have to publish what the device is. So I literally like went to the USPTO website and found dozens and dozens of these patents, and a lot of them were you know, it was stuff I couldn't really follow technically, but some of it was stuff I could. And in some instances, there were literally there were like technologies that the NSA had long been rumored to use, but there had never been any confirmation. And in fact, there were patents for them. I mean, you know, steganography and stuff like that.
Just sitting under everyone's noses, basically, in the public domain.
Yeah, it's not even. So there was stuff like that that was. And then there was another thing too, which is that because of the self-consciousness of the book, the kind of tone that I talked to some people who were like really. I mean, today writing a story for the New Yorker, I couldn't. They just wouldn't be sources because they're so unreliable and kind of wacky. But with that book, their unreliability and paranoia and wackiness in some ways was all kind of part of that universe. And so they were fair game.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember that. It's sort of like the conspiratorial part of it. First of all, it's fueled by the secrecy, but also right. It's sort of like it's wrapped up in your search for whatever answers you can find.
Right.
This.
Yeah. And I think to some extent that was the, you know, this was, again, much more true of the NSA when the book came out in 2005, but the whole area was just the province of sort of the tinfoil hat crowd in a way that's much different now. I mean, there are much more credible whistleblowers who've come out. There's been much more really good work since we know a lot more now than we did.
But although, ironically, the surveillance is probably deeper than it's ever been, even though the knowledge is greater. So
right. That
might cut against... exposure leading to more control over.
This is something I continue to wonder about. Yeah, I mean, people are not. I had sort of thought exactly. I had thought like, oh, if only the world knew, they'd be outraged. And you know, then the world found out, and they didn't really care. You know,
how much of a sort of public service is not the right word, but do you pick topics? Do you explore things that you think, all right, I'm gonna expose this, and this will make a change in the world, or is it more following the lines of what interests you and sort of looking for a good story to tell?
It's probably a little bit of both. I mean, I've been, so since finishing law school, I've hung my hat at a think tank, the Century Foundation, which has a kind of broadly progressive identity, but has given me a lot of latitude to pursue various things. So there's often a policy implication in there or a kind of policy hook of one sort or another. I tend not to like really prescriptive writing, and I as often as not, what I want to do is kind of get in and find the stories and the narratives almost as a delivery mechanism to just get people to sit up and think about it. I mean, honestly, the areas that I'm interested in are so obscure often that the thing that I want is for people just to understand and care a little bit more than they did before. It's not always, it doesn't always translate into a, you know, which is why Capitol Hill should pass a law that does X, Y, or Z.
Yeah.
I mean, and this is like another, in a weird way, another thread that runs through a lot of the work that I've done is that we're not even really at a point where you could think coherently about what your policy response would be because we just don't know. I mean, it's that we don't even know what's happening.
Like people just who are making those decisions aren't informed enough to.
They're not. Even. I mean, yeah.
I've noticed. I mean, there are a few stories where you take what's not. It's not a counterintuitive approach, but somehow I end up at a completely different place than I expected. Mm-hmm. And the one in particular is the Ecuador story. You know, about this big case against Chevron. Or I guess it was Texaco, and then Chevron bought Texaco, or vice versa. I can't remember. In fact, I think I had run into you and you were working on that story. And when you just said, oh, it's about that big case in Ecuador, I had heard about that case. People had written about that case. And I think, oh, it's just going to unravel what happened to these people. But it actually goes a completely different direction, which is it's about this lawyer and his sort of obsessive desire to take on this corporation. And the guy's not actually the hero. He's like an anti-hero, sort of. But did you go in with that frame, or did you discover that partway through and you just knew that case was interesting enough that you'd find something in it?
The thing that was really interesting to me about that case was that the guy, Stephen Donziger, had been written about a lot and had been, he's this big kind of wild and woolly personality, but also had been portrayed very heroically. And then the thing that interested me, that kind of got me interested, and that was actually an idea of my editor, Dan Zaleski at The New Yorker, to do the piece. I mean, he suggested it, but the hook initially was this idea that Chevron was getting sued by these Ecuadorians, and they turned around and sued the lawyer representing the Ecuadorians. So they kind of attacked the lawyer coming after them. When I got to know Donziger, the thing that was interesting was that in some respects he was in a really sympathetic position legally, in that he was trying to kind of right this historic wrong and hold Chevron accountable. But he's such a flawed guy that he gave them, I mean, as somebody said at one point, they said that, what he did was he basically gave a stick to Chevron with which they proceeded to beat the hell out of him. It was also tough for me because in that piece, I spent a lot of time with Stephen Donziger, and he, I'm sure you've had situations like this too, but he was eventually going to go on the record, and I kept coming back to New York and meeting with him, and each time I would arrive for the on the record interview, and he would say, well, let's just keep it on background today, but next time we'll go on the record. And so we had, I don't know, a half a dozen really long conversations. There were days I spent with him, and he ended up not going on the record. But in person, he's a very beguiling, kind of seductive character. And so it took a little bit of time for me to... I was initially just so charmed by the guy that it took a while for me to kind of dig through. And
what was... Did you get a response from him after the piece? Or I
never
guess...
heard anything.
Oh, really?
I heard from his... There was a woman who works closely with him and handles their kind of public relations for the plaintiffs, and she was very angry. I mean, it was one of these things where I, in some respects, was quite sympathetic to the position of the plaintiffs, but I also wasn't going to pull punches on their transgressions. And I think there had been a really long piece by William Langovisha in Vanity Fair about the case a few years earlier. And, he's an amazing writer, and it's a great piece, and that was a kind of a different moment in the litigation. But looking back at that, I think that's a little bit too... My feeling as I was reporting my piece was, like, that was a little bit too much of a kind of David and Goliath story. It was a bit more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm. And how do you feel about the... I'm not going to use that Janet Malcolm quote, because if there's a more overused quote in, like, media criticism...
Boy, it's a great one, though.
It is. It's worthy, but... But in terms of, getting really close to people in the stories, and then sort of how they're treated by you, are you thinking about it along the way? Or are you sort of like, all right, befriend them and then I'll have my time to sit down? Or how do you approach sources like that guy?
It's hard. I think to some extent it varies on the basis of how media savvy they are. I mean, in some instances, there are people who are, I read about Munzer Al-Kasar. He's a crazy arms dealer who has spent his life doing fairly bad things. And I don't really care what he thinks when the article comes out on some level. I mean, he's not going to be happy. He will feel on some level betrayed because, he didn't speak to me, but his daughter spoke to me, and he kind of blessed the article in a way.
And did you give him a spiel that was sort of like, I'm going to be fair? In order to get that interview, did you have to sort of lay out some argument for why?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I think some people will just sort of say no, and they see no point. The line that I'll often use with people is, it's not unique to me. I'm sure we all use it, is essentially you just say, the train is leaving the station here. I mean, the article is going to come out one way or the other. You have an opportunity to influence the narrative or not influence the narrative. I'm going to kind of play it straight and just kind of report on what I have. But I certainly wouldn't want to hear any complaints from you after the article comes out about it not adequately reflecting your view of things if you're not going to even give me any kind of access or conversation. But look, it's tough. I mean, I think they're not always, the people you talk to aren't always crooked arms dealers. And
although in your case, often.
Though they often are, it's true, which makes me feel much better about things. But the, and I do think, I mean, one thing that Jenna Malcolm, it's funny, I reread that book recently, and one thing she really nails is the, you know, there's the sort of vanity on the part of the person who decides against their better judgment to talk to you. And I think vanity often does play a role. But there's also a kind of willful, deluded, wishful thinking in which you think, I will deliver my story and this journalist who is, you know, a serious journalist and presents himself as such will be my ventriloquist and will kind of, and then there's always that feeling of betrayal. I've found that even if I tell people up front, as I've actually just done recently in a number of cases, you know, where I'll say, like, to people who aren't as familiar with the kind of rules of the road, at the outset of the interview, look, when I have all my notes and I have my recordings and what have you, I'm not going to be editing with the mind to what you'd be comfortable with. So if there's stuff you want me to know but you don't want to see it in the article, I want you to say off the record first. I mean, you can actually tell people that at the outset of a conversation, and 20 minutes later, it's either that they've forgotten it or that they, I don't know what, that there's a kind of conversational sort of fugue state you get into where you're just deluded into thinking, well, now I will say X, Y, and Z. And then, you know, I mean, at times people are pretty horrified afterwards when it.
Yeah. I mean, partly, I always think it's, you know, who has someone outside of maybe like going into therapy, who has someone actually sit down and express like genuine interest in everything that they say? It's just so, it's intoxicating to have someone just sort of like, okay, then tell me what happened. It's kind of like you want to succumb to that. Yeah. In some ways I feel like that overtakes people and against their better judgment sometimes.
It's funny, I was talking to somebody the other day who does kind of corporate investigations type stuff, and he was saying that they I mean, to me this all sounds so incredibly dodgy, but you want to find out about some company, but you don't want to say why you're finding out. So you'll essentially kind of come up with a fake identity, or you'll go in and you'll say, hi, I'm looking to make investments in, I don't know what, you know, Kazakhstan. And I know that you've been involved in Kazakhstan, and I'd just be interested in hearing about your experiences. And in fact, what you want to know about is the guy himself and what he did in Kazakhstan, but you're pretending to be somebody else, you know. And I said, how do you get them to, I would just be so innately suspicious if somebody came up to me and said, hey, tell me about your business experience. And he said, oh God, you know, everybody desperately wants to tell their story. And if it's somebody coming and saying like, oh, I'm green in this particular area of investing, I don't have a lot of experience, can you tell me about your vast wisdom based on your years in the region? They will sit down and tell you all kinds of things, which then go into the confidential report about them that goes to your corporate spy boss.
Yeah, know? Exactly. I want to talk a little bit about the this Times Magazine story, and it's been remarked upon, I think, in people who read it, and it seemed like it got a lot of attention too. That it was like a business story. It was a business story about a Mexican cartel and sort of like how it operates end to end. Did you conceive it that way, or did it end up that way?
I pitched it that way.
Yeah?
Yeah, I pitched it as a Harvard Business School case study of a cartel. And the Sinaloa is just the kind of, you know, they're the biggest, they're the most integrated and sophisticated. So if you were to do it, if you were to sort of test that proposition on a cartel, that would be the best one to do it on.
Mm-hmm. And then, but it's so sprawling. I mean, there must have been dozens of court cases or more than dozens of court cases involving these guys. How long was the process of doing that story?
6 months.
And the question I always wonder about with a story like that is, how did you know when you were done? Because it seems like there's an endless amount of information. You could keep going back to Mexico. You could keep going and digging into finding more court cases. How did you sort of decide, okay, this is the scope of what I want to do, and now I've accomplished it?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably a lot, it's funny, in talking to a lot of people who write these kinds of long pieces, I think a lot of us wrestle with this, but I overreport. I mean, you know, I knew I was done probably a month or 6 weeks after I was done, if that makes sense. You get into it, and particularly when you, on the investigative stuff, I mean, it takes on a logic of its own that's actually really counterproductive for me, where if there's some document that they won't give me access to, or if there's some element of the chronology, at a certain point, it doesn't matter how potentially important it is to the story. I just kind of want to see if I can get it.
Yeah.
And in terms of managing my own time, I'm realizing that's something I need to get a lot better at, because I go chasing after some stupid shit, you know, and I end up with a level of granular detail that actually makes the writing harder, because there's so much stuff, and a lot of it is like cool stuff that you then try, and you're just shoehorning stuff in all over the place that's going to come out in the first edit, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I guess the question is, does all of that sort of leach into your, having that detail sort of leach into your brain in a way that you actually couldn't, yeah, it's going to come out, but you actually couldn't write the story if you hadn't gone and gotten it?
I think maybe it's that. I mean, this kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about how I have this kind of risk aversion gene. But I, if there's one thing that really bugs me, and maybe this is especially acute living in Washington, it's kind of faux expertise. It's people blathering on about something they don't actually know or understand in a lot of detail. And I think journalists are guilty of this, but boy, policy people are too. And academics are too. I mean, there's nothing that drives me crazier than academics who will sort of, you know, they have this kind of social scientific approach, but then when you actually look at their end notes, it's all newspaper articles, you know, and I'm sort of wondering, what are you, you know, so what are you actually basing this on? So some of it, I think, for me is almost a kind of prophylactic sense that I don't want to weigh in on this until I really feel like I've kind of gotten in there and really understood it. Mm-hmm. And so maybe you're right. I mean, maybe that's part of it, is just having the confidence to write in a way, even if the vast majority of the stuff isn't going to end up on the page.
Right. And you took a year off from journalism, or I don't know if you would describe it that way, but
yeah.
I'm really, tell me a little bit about what you're doing and sort of how that came about.
Yeah. My spooky interlude. So after I moved to Washington, I was introduced to a guy who worked at the Pentagon in the Office of the Secretary of Defense.
This is after the Snakehead book came out.
Yeah, yeah. This was after the Snakehead had come out, and it was sort of just after it came out. And at that point, I'd already been writing about these kind of transnational crime issues quite a bit in a series of articles and in that book. And this guy had read some of my stuff and basically said, you know, what would you think about coming in for a year to the government and getting a clearance and being a kind of, almost like a kind of fellow. This guy worked within the Office of the Secretary of Defense in like their drugs and thugs shop, which amazingly, because of the war on drugs being very popular on Capitol Hill, this one little office had a $1.4 billion budget. And
when you say little, how little is the actual
office? The
office
is about, it's small. It's about the size of the Adams office, actually, though they have a few more staff. And it's called Counter Narcotics and Global Threats. And I was sort of more on the global threats side of the ledger, but it was all the fun, I mean, fun from my perspective stuff. So it's Somali piracy and money laundering and, you know, gun running. And
they're trying to figure out the sort of national security implications of those things and what's going on in each of those areas.
Yeah, so it's a policy shop, but they also are, you know, they're kind of, some of it is looking at places where DOD is actually active. Some of it is thinking about what should our policy response be. I mean, so, you know, if there is a ship hit by Somali pirates, should the U.S. Navy feel that it needs to go in and intervene in some way? You know, does it matter if there are Americans on board? What if there aren't Americans on board? What if the ship is, you know, owned by an American company but flying another flag, or, you know, whatever? All those kinds of questions. And also a lot of questions relating to the drug trade as well. And So it was an amazing experience. I mean, it was really, it was kind of a technocratic education, right? I sort of figured out a little bit about the nature of the dysfunction of the bureaucracy, and saw these issues from the inside, which was great. And frankly, I mean, got a clearance and like read a lot of classified stuff, which if you're somebody who has thought about these issues from the outside is an appealing notion in some ways.
Did it sort of confirm what you thought, or were you surprised at what you found?
Well, I mean, what was disappointing to me, and as a journalist and kind of dispiriting to me as a citizen, was that in many instances, at least in these areas that I'm obsessed with, we didn't know all that much more than you can get from good investigative journalists. So even with all the resources of the CIA and the NSA and, you know, DIA and whatever else, there are these areas that remain incredibly obscure. And there were a number of those that I was kind of looking into, where I would kind of pitch an approach to a given thing and sort of say, okay, well, let's pull together everybody from the interagency and see what we know about it. And the answer was sometimes less than you would hope.
Hmm. Was there a possibility of staying longer than a year?
There was. But I think I kind of got it. You know, I think I kind of hit an inflection point at about 10 months where the really steep, like vertiginous learning curve began to plateau a bit. And, I think I also had a realization that, in order for me to, I mean, I missed writing, honestly, and I wanted to kind of get back out and have that autonomy, but also, I didn't really have much of an impact, frankly. I think it's hard to have an impact in the government. I got way more out of the experience than they got out of me. And looking around at the people who do have an impact, I realized that I'd have to stick around for a long time to kind of become like a bureaucratic ninja. And they exist, and it's amazing to see them do what they do. But I don't think that you can, like, being precocious is almost never enough. There are people like that. I mean, you know, Jake Sullivan is the head of policy planning at the State Department. He's a young guy. I was at law school with him. It's amazing what he's been able to do as somebody who's fairly new to government. But those people are pretty few and far between in terms of people get really effective. So I think that was part of it, too.
I should have touched on this earlier, but I'm just really curious about sort of like your story discovery process. Like, where do these things come from? And do you have sort of standard ways for looking for stories, or keep story file? Like, how do you literally do you come into the stories, whether the New York Magazine story about the murder capital of New York or the cartels or whatever? Like, do those emerge from the same process, or is it different every time?
It's random. And at this point, I mean, it has gotten to a point which is both good and bad, which is that people are always suggesting stuff. That's mostly bad, honestly, because most of the ideas are interesting, but not when the piece is going to take you like 4, 5, 6 months to do, you tend to be very, very choosy about it. So, but random ways. I mean, the piece about Newberg was like a front page story in the Times. There was a big raid, and it just seemed so weird to me that you had this huge gang raid in this tiny little kind of picturesque part of the. Up on the Hudson, this small town.
Mm-hmm.
That struck me as just kind of inherently intriguing and weird. And then I found out that it was the most dangerous part of the state and much more dangerous than New York City. And then I found out that the FBI guy there was just kind of an amazing, galvanizing, interesting character. So that all kind of fell into line. A lot of the time it's seeing some little thing. Or, I mean, not that a front page story in the Times is little, but, you know, getting an inkling. And I think talking to other reporters, you get this. I think a lot of us have this in a weird way. If you're writing at 8,000 words, you have this luxury, which is that, to some extent, the first draft of all this stuff is daily reporters doing their stories. And often you can read that story and sort of get an inkling that, oh, there's more, you know, this is great, but you could do this at more than 1,200 words. There's probably more if I were to dig into this. Increasingly, it's about finding those characters.
And you generally go in with the characters in hand?
Yeah.
Like the investigator in the Newberg story, yeah. That guy.
I think you need them because at least for the, in terms of the stuff that I write, there's always a level of, I think just because I'm really into complexity, you know, and these complicated stories and figuring out how to kind of tell them as a narrative that is going to be explicable. And there's almost always some kind of court process or some, you know, there's often like a document angle on the stuff that I'm looking at. So it's teasing that out and finding the story. Unless you have a Virgil, you know, unless you have somebody who the reader can kind of latch onto to guide them through that thicket of crap, you know? Mm-hmm. I just think it's too tough sometimes.
To just structure around. So a couple more things. One is, do you have any stories sitting on your hard drive, kill stories that you are like the lost, the one that never made it? Or,
I mean, it's stuff that gets abandoned all the time. And there's also been, I mean, you know, it's very often the case with me that there'll be some story that we all have this experience, right? But that you find something and you think, what an amazing story. As soon as I get out from under on this project I'm working on now, I'm going to pitch it. And then someone else does it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just happened dozens of times. I think in some ways, when you do this kind of writing, we all have similar instincts. And you can see, when you read about it in the paper, you can tell there's a great feature there. The question then becomes, who's going to get their shit together to do it first?
There's something kind of sad about it to me sometimes when you just see something and you know, like, editors all over New York just picked up the phone and called somebody, or like, it's true that it's the same instincts, but it also seems like a weird herd mentality for a tiny herd.
Totally.
It's a little bitty herd of people who are right. All sort of like, oh, that's a great feature story.
And the thing is, I mean, and here's the tricky thing, is that they're all reading the same publications. I mean, you do get a kind of, and they're all on Twitter with each other. So you get this kind of strange echo chamber thing. I mean, there are, I should have this kind of story with many, many more publications. But for instance, I get the American Bar Association Journal. Because I'm a member of the bar, it comes for free. And there are stories in it that are actually kind of great and that don't get covered a lot. And like The American Lawyer, and you know, there are these various stories that I've, and sometimes it'll be a thing where I read about something in another context and I find out like the one big piece was written in The American Lawyer. Any kind of local papers or specialist periodicals, I mean, anything you can do to kind of break out of that somewhat insular information universe we're all in that seems limitless but is actually pretty cloistered, I think is probably a good idea. I always assume that David Graham, you know, immerses himself in bizarre.
Who knows what he's reading? I got really obsessed with that for a while, and I started subscribing. I was subscribing to like Mortuary Management magazine. It still shows up at one of my old addresses sometimes. Like, you can take that to a level where you're not really. It's just about the act of it. It's not actually finding any stories, but
I guess, yeah. But I do think there's something to it, though. That the finding that thing that's just totally, completely off the radar. It would probably be a huge advantage.
And then the last thing I wanted to ask was just about, you mentioned with Chatter, you would do that book completely differently now. Are there any other sort of do-overs or do you have any that have sort of blown up in some way afterwards, you know, in terms of you realize the story should have been different or you information came to light you didn't have or anything like that?
I don't think that there have been things that have blown up. I mean, one of the things that's a little strange is watching, spending 4 months on something or 5 months and really immersing yourself in it. And then you have your piece, which kind of aspires to be the definitive piece, but the story continues to evolve. And it's been interesting watching The New Yorker deal with this. They've started increasingly having people kind of revisit things on the website, which I think is great and something I want to do more of. But I mean, you know, I wrote a piece about wine fraud and that case, I think that piece came out, I don't remember, in 2007 or 2008 or something. That case has continued to kind of do all these interesting things. And I kind of keep an eye on it. Anyway, so that has a kind of a weird... The Chevron case is another one. I mean, it keeps getting... And what it means for me is, honestly, like, anytime there's a new story, I'll tweet about it, which is, in some respects, totally unsatisfying. But it's kind of the best I can do at the moment. It's strange though, because I guess the best you can do is kind of give a snapshot at a moment in time. And
yeah. All right, we got to get you to doing an actual public speaking engagement. So thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
All right.
Thanks for listening to Longform. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, if you want to check out the articles Patrick and Evan were just talking about, they're in the show notes at longform.org/podcast. There's links in there for Patrick's books, too, Chatter and the Snakehead. You should buy them. Thanks, as always, to Lauren Kirchner, our editor, and to Tiny Letter, our sponsor. Until next week.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.